I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Been looking forward to this interview. E.J. Dionne is our guest this hour. His latest book is Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. He says that we haven't been the same since Goldwater's version of conservatism became the philosophy's dominant form, and a narrative of disappointment and betrayal became movement's signature story. Loyal conservatives have been upset that promises made over and over again were not kept. The book covers so much, of course, Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon and George Herbert Walker Bush and George W. Bush and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and Donald Trump and other Republicans who are running for office. And he did so many interviews with conservative thinkers. EJ says he comes at this question as an unapologetic liberal of social democratic inclinations and a temperate disposition, which indeed he has. Also, he says, a respect for the conservative tradition as rooted in his own experiences. EJ grew up as a conservative in a conservative family and remembers as a 12-year-old watching Ronald Reagan's 1964 A Time for Choosing speech on behalf of Barry Goldwater, which he writes about in the book. He is a Washington Post syndicated columnist, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, professor at Georgetown, commentator for National Public Radio and MSNBC. He has worked at the New York Times covering state, local, and national politics, and also a foreign correspondent. Joined the Post in 90 as a political reporter. He is the author of 6 books, including Why Americans Hate Politics, which was a National Book Award nominee and winner of the LA Times Book Prize. We'll be welcoming phone calls for EJ as we chat this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. EJ, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, it's so great to be with you, and that was such a warm and perfect summary of the book that I think I'm going to ask you to accompany me on all interviews and talks about the book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, E.J. So I must ask you, I guess, we've been waiting here in the Midwest for your storm in the East, which we've been hearing about for 2 days. Has it happened yet?
Well, no, it's actually a beautiful day out, but they tell us that starting tomorrow, we are going to get perhaps 30 inches of snow.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Express complete solidarity with the people of Wisconsin. And a lot of us, I plan to go out to Iowa next week and spend the rest of the week out there for the caucuses. And there's a lot of doubt about whether our airport will be open even by Tuesday. So we'll see how this all
works. Oh, it'll all clear up. Let's go back. I found this interesting because I didn't know you this about you. You grew up as a conservative in a conservative family, and you write about this speech. But go back to your 12-year-old self watching Ronald Reagan.
It's one of my favorite columns, by the way, that I ever wrote, which is my dad died in 1968, and we spent a wonderful time talking and then arguing about politics. And I started becoming a liberal when I was about 13, and I read Martin Luther King's book, a collection of his sermons, Strength to Love, for a religion class. It was my pick. We could pick a book to review, and that was the one I picked. And that and some other things started me on the journey to where I am now. But the column was about my dad, and we had very warm, happy, civilized arguments together, and we enjoyed it. It wasn't hostile. And it gave me a whole attitude toward argument for the rest of my life, and I've always been grateful to my dad for that. But we were a conservative family, and for conservatives of a certain age out there, they might remember what it was like sitting there when Goldwater was going down to defeat, and it was no secret to anybody. And then along comes this actor, Ronald Reagan, who gave this incredibly compelling speech, if you were conservative. It was not, I don't think, a persuasive speech to people who disagreed, but it was a speech that rallied the movement. And all over the country, it's one thing that Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama very much have in common. Reagan's career was really set off by that one speech, and then conservatives rallied to him, just as Barack Obama's career nationally was set off by that one speech at the Democratic National Convention. And in the book, I compare the impact of these two speeches, both how they're similar, but also how they were quite different one from the other.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, you write about both, that Reagan is thought of as the conservative leader, and yet you say that his policies were much more nuanced and really didn't fit one philosophy. On the other hand, President Obama is thought of as a socialist by those who don't like him very much, and he's probably quite moderate.
Right. Well, in fact, along comes Bernie Sanders. I think whatever people, wherever people end up in the Democratic fight, I think Bernie Sanders has done a public service by telling us, wait a minute, there is a position, a small D Democratic position, to the left of where President Obama is. And President Obama is actually a very moderate sort of progressive. But I think that Reagan, the first chapter in the book is about Reagan because mm-hmm. You know, I think everything conservative starts with Ronald Reagan, revering him as part of the conservative liturgy. But the chapter is called The Ambiguous Hero, because I think that it is legit for movement conservatives to view him as a hero of the movement, because that's what he was, certainly in the Goldwater years and his years as a speaker out in the country in the 50s and 60s, right until he became governor. But the governing Reagan was always far more pragmatic, and also he was governing with the Democratic Congress under Tip O'Neill, and he adjusted to that. And on foreign policy, he was far less of an interventionist than we remember him. He sent those troops to Lebanon, which I to this day believe was an awful mistake. We recall they were 241 of them were killed in a terrorist attack, and I happened to be over in Lebanon right before that.
Oh,
and interviewed a lot of those Marines who basically said they were defenseless there. But Reagan immediately took the lesson from that. He pulled them out, and as I point out in the book, there were a lot of Republican hawks at the time, including very strong Reagan supporters who were unhappy with him for not committing troops elsewhere. The only foreign policy, the only war he got engaged in was in Grenada, which obviously wasn't a very big war,
mm-hmm.
And ended very, very, very quickly. So that Goldwater is really the person who started the movement. And you were kind to say at the beginning, I did talk to a lot of conservatives who all know I'm a liberal, and they knew what I was up to. But we had some very interesting and productive conversations. One of the people I talked to, it was Bill Kristol, who kind of corrected himself in mid-conversation because we were talking about the Tea Party, and he said, you know, the Tea Party has to understand the governing Reagan as well as the movement Reagan. And then he said, really, the Tea Party has to become less Goldwaterite. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you want to understand Republican ideology, you have to go back to Goldwater. You have to go back to his book, The Conscience of a Conservative, which was published in 1960. But if you put a different name on it and republished exactly the same book now, except for the references to the Soviet Union, which are obviously out of date, almost everything else in that book would sound like a Tea Party manifesto.
Interesting. So what was Goldwater's version of conservatism, E.J.?
Well, Goldwater was, you know, the ultimate small government conservative, and he was so small government that it lost him, it lost him the election. There's a line in the Conscience of a Conservative where he says, I have little interest in streamlining government or making it more efficient, for I mean to reduce its size. And he was against farm programs, and he was for privatizing Social Security. He wanted, you know, to dismantle significant parts of the federal government. And another conservative I talked to, Vin Weber, the former congressman from Minnesota, tells a wonderful story where he was an ardent 11-year-old Goldwaterite, Vin was, and he said he wanted two aunts of his, older aunts of his, put up a Goldwater sign. And they said, well, we don't really want to do that. We'll put up a sign that says, vote Republican, we're Republicans. And young Vin asked them, why don't you want to put up a Goldwater sign? And they said, well, we don't really like what he says about Social Security. And Vin said that was his first lesson in political realism as an 11-year-old. But this was the Goldwater who promised a very small government, and so much of the rhetoric we're hearing these days from Republicans could be drawn right out of his speech. It was funny, his speeches, it was funny. I was on Brian Lehrer, who runs another great talk show on NPR in New York City, played a Goldwater speech at the beginning of our chat. And It could have been given now. He might have been playing an excerpt from one of the Republican debates.
Interesting. You talk about how the country, and I think that it's important to take this broader view, that on a lot of social issues, you mentioned the Confederate flag issue, the horrible massacre in South Carolina, and the flag coming down, which was a statement, the same-sex marriage that happened. In so many significant ways, the country is moving in a different direction. We're becoming more minority. We're accepting same-sex marriage, for heaven's sake. Imagine Goldwater dealing with that in 1960 or 1964. So the country is moving in this rather progressive way. And so some of the old rhetoric, particularly on social issues, doesn't work anymore because we're not there anymore.
No, I think that's true. And yet the party itself still, in the primaries, a lot of that rhetoric is still there. I'd like to use your question to anticipate a fair question that some of your Republican or conservative listeners might ask me, which is, if conservatism is in so much trouble, why are the Republicans in better shape in state houses, in state legislatures, than they have been really since the 1920s?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to that, I think, is the reason for that is also the reason why conservatives and Republicans have to worry about the future. They have won those big victories in midterm elections in 2010 and 2014 because the midterm electorate is far older than the electorate in presidential years. And the Democratic Party is far more dependent on the votes of young people than it's ever been. And as we know, young voters, partly because of election laws and partly because they're not as settled yet as older people are, don't vote in the same numbers. Now, that has helped Republicans a lot in the midterms, and then they've been able to use their control in state legislatures to draw district lines, to gerrymander district lines that benefit them. Both parties do that, but Republicans happen to control more states right now. But the bad news in that is that means the average age of the average Republican is very, very high. And that does not bode well for the future. When Ronald Reagan was president in 1987, I was looking at these numbers today that are in the book, there were 39% of Republicans were over 50. Now that figure is 53%.
Ooh.
So an aging, almost uniformly white political coalition just cannot mm-hmm. own the future.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that Republicans have to sort of think about hard. And as you mentioned at the beginning, it's 39% and 53%, the numbers. Mm. As you mentioned at the beginning, on a lot of these social issues, gay marriage is one of the most generationally dependent attitudes, if you will, that young people are overwhelmingly in favor of gay marriage, including quite conservative young people, and that the opposition is primarily among older Americans, and even among in that group, the percentage is going down of opposition.
You also, and we've talked a lot about this on this show, you talk about George W. Bush's stance on immigration and look at the percentage of Latino vote he received and contrast that with Mitt Romney. I really wonder what's going to happen in this next election. I can't imagine much Latino vote at all for the Republican nominee.
No, obviously it depends on who wins the nomination. And, there are his supporters hope that Marco Rubio, for example, would be someone who could turn that around. But Rubio has been forced, or chose to be forced, if you will, by prevailing opinion in the party to turn very hard on immigration, where he was a co-sponsor, helped write the immigration reform law that passed the Senate. And then when Tea Party opposition arose, he turned on it. Ted Cruz, also Latino, was against immigration reform. And so, yes, and then, if the Republicans were to nominate somebody like Trump and Cruz, Mitt Romney got, if I recall, 26% of the Latino vote. That could go down. It's very hard, given the strategic location of Latinos, for Republicans to win a national election if that's their share of the Latino vote. George W. Bush, on the other hand, got 40%, or by some measures a little bit more, of the Latino vote. The Republicans just cannot throw away this giant constituency. I have a Republican consultant friend once told me, it doesn't really work if we go to Latinos and say, we really want you to vote for us, even though we wish you weren't here.
Yeah, exactly. That doesn't work, right.
That was a Republican consultant saying, we got to get this right.
All right, before we go to phone calls, I just want to go back a little bit prior to Barry Goldwater. You remind us of Eisenhower, a very moderate Republican, well-liked in the country. Why is it that the Republican Party didn't continue on that course? Was there a latent dissatisfaction among many in this country that the New Deal was awful?
Right. Well, see, I mean, Ike is a kind of hero of my book because I do believe that in the early 60s, the conservatives had two paths. One was the one laid out by Goldwater and people like Bill Buckley, whom I respect in many ways, but who really hated Eisenhower and whose views on a number of issues I strongly disagree with. So that was one path. The other path was Eisenhower. And I not only make the case that Eisenhower was a successful Republican model, you only have to look at his sweeping landslides in 52 and 56, but I argue he was a conservative, but he was a conservative of a kind of old-fashioned Burkean sort, who accepted incremental change, which conservatives always had, who was trying to preserve the American way of life. He was a very fiscally prudent president. The budgets were very close to balance or in balance under Ike. And he was very pro-business. But he also understood that certain social changes become part of the fabric of the country. So he didn't try to roll back the New Deal because he said, candidly, A, the voters wouldn't go for it, and these are part of how we do business now. We responded to the Great Depression. And there was this kind of conservatism all across of the democracies at the time. Harold Macmillan represented it in Britain. Konrad Adenauer represented it in Germany. It was a temperate conservatism that was trying to preserve what was good, was not overly, not hugely enthusiastic about change, but was willing to accept certain change and, of course, certain government actions. And Ike gave us, after all, the interstate highway system and the federal student loan program, which helped me go to college, I might note.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have many of them, EJ. We have a ton of phone calls, actually, which I expected we would. EJ Dionne is our guest this hour, and his book, which is such a worthwhile read, filled with history and really, good thought. He's a thoughtful, smart man. The book is Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. E.J. Dionne is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. E.J. Dionne is with us now. When we go to phone calls, Tim in Waukesha is our first caller. Hi, Tim.
Hi, it's an honor to talk to both of you. I think it's fair to say that the Republican Party has two wings. There's the working class, white, socially conservative, and then the economic, wealthy conservative. My question for EJ is, does he see Donald Trump as being a cannibalization of the party? Because he is seen as anti-establishment, even though, from my perspective, most Republicans would fit under the Donald Trump wing of the party, which is kind of bore out by all the polls.
First of all, thanks for your kind words at the top there about both of us. And cannibalization is a fascinating term. There is something to that. The Trump is partly a traditional figure and partly sui generis. What he represents that's kind of in the mainstream of at least part of the conservative movement is this sense of disappointment and anger that people sold us out. He's obviously represents the nativist wing of the Republican Party, or the part that's really uncomfortable with immigrants. This, I think, if I may say so, absurd promise to deport 11 million Mexican Americans and some really pretty hideous things he said about them. There is that it's an extreme statement of what a lot of people in the party feel about immigration. On the other side, I think you are absolutely right to underscore how much of Trump's support comes from, if you will, working class Republicans or lower income Republicans. And I write about this a lot in the book, and I think it's something that both Democrats and Republicans have to pay attention to, which is that, there are many different kinds of people in the country who suffer from injustice, including, and we've been rightly talking about a lot, African Americans, particularly in our inner cities, but also in other parts of the country. But white working class people have also been hammered in this new economy, as we've shifted away from unionized industrial jobs to other kind of work that pays people a whole lot less. The Republicans have gotten a lot of white working class votes for election after election, particularly but not exclusively in the South. And in the book, I quote a number of Republicans, people like, and conservatives, people like Ross Douthat, who writes a column for the New York Times, or Raihan Salam, who point out that these voters have voted Republican have gotten no material benefits from doing so. And so in a lot of ways, for these voters, Trump is their revenge. It's odd to have a billionaire leading a working class rebellion,
yes,
but that is part of what's going on with Trump. So I very much agree with your the framing of the question. And, you know, and this is not original to me. I think you're seeing this very interesting split now, even within movement conservatives, because Trump represents this sort of populist or faux populist kind of conservatism, and Ted Cruz represents much more the hard, old, ideological conservatives. So Iowa, the Iowa caucuses, with a quite conservative electorate, is turning in part into a showdown, not only between two kinds of conservatism, but two kinds of part of conservatism, the right end of conservatism.
Mm. You know what is troubling to me, EJ, and it must be to you as well, is what Trump has done to the whole level of discourse about issues. You know, people are stupid. It's a stupid idea. His, as you call it, excoriation of Mexican immigrants, what he said about Muslims, what he's, you know, making fun of reporters who have handicaps. I mean, there's a point where you just say, we really need a little bit more kindness in this country. This is just not good.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, there's a lot of meanness all the way around, but Trump sort of takes meanness to a new level. And there is also this authoritarian streak there that I think is very troubling, because he's constantly talking about weak and strong. The biggest criticism that Donald Trump makes against anyone is, you know, and he's done this, for example, to Jeb Bush, you know, saying that they're weak.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that there is this authoritarian piece that I think is very alarming for the future. I mean, you know, if you want to be as sympathetic as possible to the people who are voting for Trump, and I do, as I said in the earlier question, I do have a lot of empathy for the folks who are hurting in this economy. But that's one thing, but it's another for him to lay out as a solution this, you know, one man, Donald Trump, can solve all of this. I mean, we've been there at other times in history, not so much our country, but other countries, and I don't think that's where we want to go.
So let's spend just a little more time before we go back to phone calls. You write that the party, the Republican Party, had created the rough beast in reference to Trump that it was suddenly trying to slay. How did the Republican Party create him?
Well, let's look over the last 7 years since President Obama was elected. There wasn't early on very much pushback when people fought. People, notably, by the way, including Trump, said that he was ineligible to be president because he wasn't born in the United States,
yes,
or because he was a Muslim, or that a health care plan that was built on, you know, in many cases, Republican ideas introduced by people like Bob Dole and John Chafee, that this was some kind of a radical socialist experiment. And the party establishment was happy to use these sentiments to sort of gin up opposition to Obama. They, even if they snickered at her privately, you know, Sarah Palin was out there preparing the way for, you know, endorsing Trump this week, but they used her in every way they could to mobilize the vote for the 2010 election. So, you know, the line I am very fond of is from John F. Kennedy in his inaugural address, where he said, those who foolishly ride to power on the back of the tiger usually end up inside.
Mm.
And I think that's what's happened to a lot of people in the so-called Republican establishment. You saw John Boehner kind of eaten alive by these forces that partly helped make him speaker. And so that's why I think the Republican, you know, establishment or traditional Republicans, whatever you want to call that leadership, does have a lot to answer for, and they may be unhappy now, but I do think they prepared the way for the election we're having, the primaries we're having.
Tim, thanks for the call. Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
You know, first of all, I very much admire your work, Mr. Dionne. It's a genuine pleasure to be able to speak with you. We always hear that we've gotten so polarized, the Democrats have moved so far to the left and the Republicans have moved so far to the right. But as you listen to these various talk shows, and Kathleen's is a very good example, we sometimes hear people calling in, identifying themselves as former Republicans, but they can't relate to the party because it's moved so far to the right. How often, Kathleen, have you heard people call in saying, you know, I used to be a Democrat, but it's moved so far to the left that I can't relate?
Oh, that's an interesting point. I don't think I've heard that, Scott.
Yeah, and I don't think I have either, listening as much as I do to fine shows like yours. So I'll let Mr. Dionne answer.
All right.
Question.
Thanks,
Thank
Scott.
You so much.
Thanks. And you write about this, EJ.
Right. No, I'm very grateful for that question because I am very much a believer in the idea that we are asymmetrically polarized. My friends Tom Mann and Orm Ornstein wrote about this in their book, which they're doing a new edition of. You're not supposed to plug other people's books, but I love Norm and Tom, and their book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, is coming out in a new edition. And in the book, I very much deal with this, whether it's symmetrical or asymmetrical, and I think the data are pretty clear. Data points. In 2014, Pew Research Center, well-respected by all sides, I think, found that among Republicans, 67% called themselves conservative. Only 32% said they were moderate or liberal. Among Democrats, only 34% called themselves liberal. The vast majority, 63%, were either moderate or conservative. So these are two quite different parties ideologically. Pew asked another question a year earlier. Do you prefer elected officials who, quotes, make compromises with people they disagree with or those who, quotes, stick to their positions? Among Democrats, 59% preferred compromise seekers. Only 36% of Republicans did. So this is not the same thing on each side. Now, again, trying to anticipate what somebody out there on the other side of politics might be thinking, you say, well, what about Bernie Sanders? I think that, number one, Bernie Sanders is, as I said at the beginning of the show, showing that there is a left and it's out there. Number two, in the national polls, as against the polls in Iowa and New Hampshire, Bernie's getting about a third of the vote. But I think what you're also seeing on the Democratic side is a frustration with the obstruction of the last 7 years and a desire to have somebody out there full-throated, and that's who Bernie is. But when you look at all this data on the two parties and how different they are, I just think, I agree with your caller. This is not the same thing. It's not symmetrical in terms of polarization.
So those conservative Democrats used to be Republicans, some of them?
Well, we went through a very big realignment, as you know, with the civil rights years. It had been a long time in coming. I actually, in the book, go back briefly to the New Deal, where you began to see white Southern conservatives break with Roosevelt, even though they remained inside the Democratic Party. And then they started fleeing the party, white conservative white Southerners, with the Goldwater election, and it's just that realignment has continued. So a lot of those old conservative Democrats, particularly in the South, are now Republicans. But that call forth a realignment in the North and the Midwest, where in a lot of places, the collar counties, the suburban counties around cities, the collar counties like Montgomery County in Pennsylvania right outside of Philly, those counties have become much more Democratic. So you have had a trade of conservatives for liberals, but in many cases, it's a trade of conservatives for moderates. A lot of these new folks into either independent status or the Democratic Party were people who were moderate Republicans. And I do spend a lot of time in the book talking about both the liberal and the moderate Republican tradition, for which I have a lot of sympathy, I have to say. But again, so you have had a realignment, and each party is more ideologically consistent in its membership. But again, the Republican Party is quite a lot more conservative than the Democratic Party is liberal.
800-486-8655 is our number. E.J. Dionne is our guest this hour. His new book, Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. Jim in Rice Lake is next. Thanks for the call, Scott. Hi, Jim.
Yes, for your speaker, Kathleen, I just wanted to point out, if he argues in some ways that Eisenhower represented the Edward Burke wing of the Republican Party, which, but for historical reasons, people should know he's an Irishman and a graduate of my alma mater, Trinity College Dublin. The current Republican leadership, in my opinion, are within the tradition of Machiavelli, particularly with the assistance of ALEC, the American Legislative Economic Council, by gerrymandering states like Wisconsin, where in 2012, 54% of Wisconsinites voted for Democrats, but we have only 37% representation and one-party rule. And does this not violate a constitutional principle of one man, one vote, and a complete denial of their supposed conservative tradition of supporting the Constitution? Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, you know, first of all, you're quite right about gerrymanders all across states where Republicans took full control in 2010. Wisconsin is one of the extreme cases. So Pennsylvania may be even more extreme in terms of the actual votes cast versus the seats. You've got a gerrymander like that in Virginia. And you had a couple of counter-Democratic gerrymanders in my own state of Maryland, for example. But the number of seats affected, here it's shifted one seat, whereas you look at these other states, there were a bunch of seats shifted Republican. As a constitutional matter, so far the litigation has been mixed in terms of what the Supreme Court has been willing to do. I would like every state to move toward a nonpartisan system the way they have, for example, in Iowa, right near you there, where, you know, the voters should pick the politicians shouldn't pick their voters. That's a pretty good principle. So it is a real problem. You know, but again, on this one, I want to be fair, because I've covered reapportionments, God help me, for over 30 years, and both parties do it, but right now the Republicans are in a much stronger position to do it. And by the way, technology makes all kinds of things more efficient. Technology has made gerrymanders more efficient, and the Republicans used it with a vengeance in 2011.
Mm-hmm. There is a case that the lower federal court has agreed that the Wisconsin has a case looking at Wisconsin and other states that the state that it can go forward, their lawsuit can go forward. Can you, in your wildest imagination, imagine the Supreme Court taking up this issue of gerrymandering, AJ?
I think it's possible, although, you know, with this court, you know, the court that gave us Citizens United, which is one of my least favorite decisions in American history that opened the gates to all the big money, I'm not optimistic. But they've taken shots at this, sort of partial shots. So I think it is possible, because as the earlier caller said, when the actual votes cast are so far out of line from the results you end up with in terms of either membership of Congress or state legislatures, there really is an equal protection problem for voters. But I am not a lawyer, so I would maybe a learned lawyer can call in and say whether they think it's such an equal protection argument could fly.
Mm-hmm. Jim, thanks for your call. Mike in Brookfield, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I've been listening with interest, but I think that the primary reason why the conservative movement in this country has accelerated from the late 80s through now and sharpened to a substantial degree is primarily due to the evisceration of the middle class, and not so much by leadership or the specific message that they're putting out, but just generally that as people feel like they are not moving forward in their lives or in comparison to their parents, that they look for someone to blame. And the politics of reaction are the politics of blame.
Hmm. Interesting point, EJ.
One of the reasons I love doing your show is your callers are really smart.
Aren't they smart?
And really
thank
great
you,
observations.
EJ, for saying
I mean,
that. Right.
I think it's very clearly true that when you have broadly shared prosperity, we tend to be a bit more generous. you know, Reinhold Niebuhr, I think I've said this before on your show, is one of my favorite thinkers, the theologian, who said original sin is the only empirically verifiable doctrine of the Christian church, meaning that we human beings are not always as good or generous as we should be, but we find it easier to be socially generous and open to others when we're not feeling insecure. I just think that's very basic. So I agree with the caller on that, but I do think that it's a challenge for those of us who are progressive because, you know, these voters, many of these voters used to be Democratic. Many of them were at the heart, or their grandparents were at the heart of the New Deal coalition. And so I think that while what you say is absolutely true, it's also true that I think progressives have an obligation to come up with some answers that these voters think will work. I think the Affordable Care Act, ironically, is something that actually does benefit voters in this situation. If you look at Kentucky, almost all of the people who benefited from from Obamacare were white working class, lower middle class people. And what's interesting is that a very conservative governor got elected with the votes of many of these folks, but he surprised a lot of people by suggesting maybe he won't roll back Obamacare after all, Connect, as it's called, in Kentucky. But so I think Republicans are being called on the carpet in their own party for not delivering to these folks. But I think Democrats have both a moral and, I think, in their own interest, a political obligation to answer their concerns and to offer an alternative to a politics rooted in pure resentment.
I'm going to go back to Ronald Reagan for a moment. As you write, he remains the dominant figure of the conservative imagination. People still mention him on the campaign trail, no matter how conservative they may be. A couple questions for you about him, because he really has dominated American life for a good part of many of the people listening's lives. You say it's become a habit of liberals, especially since the rise of the Tea Party, to say that Reagan, who served as president, would have no chance of winning a Republican nomination. Do you think that's true, EJ? And why does he remain so prominent among people whose philosophy may be quite a bit different than Reagan's?
Right. In the book, I there was a writer for the very liberal Daily Coast website who listed all of the progressive things or non-conservative things that Ronald Reagan did, ranging from raising taxes a couple of times to signing a Social Security reform that was pretty much the exact opposite of privatization. Also worth noting that Reagan understood earlier than most people, and it really bothered conservatives, that Gorbachev in the Soviet Union was a very different sort of figure. I argue that, the conservatives may give Reagan credit for winning the Cold War because of his military buildup, but it may have actually been Reagan the peacenik who saw an opportunity with Gorbachev who helped end the Cold War. So all that's true, but Reagan really was a conservative figure in other respects. He did do the arms buildup. He was an anti-communist. He cut taxes on the rich. He gave us a very different tax structure than we have now. He cut deregulation. He cut the regulation of business quite sharply. He did go after the Environmental Protection Agency. The difference between Reagan and some other conservatives is when he faced opposition and realized that he had gone too far, he often pulled back, partly for political reasons or pragmatic reasons. So there is all of that ambiguity in Reagan. But why do conservatives identify with him? The same reason a lot of us identify with the people we identify with. Reagan was broadly seen as a success. He won two landslides. He won two of the greatest conservative landslides in our history. The economy got better under Reagan, whether you attribute that to Reagan's policies or not. I attribute it to kind of Keynesian economics because he ran big deficits. And so conservatives at the end of the Reagan era felt, well, the country was happy, it was in a good mood, and so it's a kind of golden era for them. Partly in the same way, to some degree, the end of the 90s is a golden era for Democrats. I mean, we also felt very good about ourselves in 1999 and 2000, despite the impeachment of Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm. So if you put him in the mix now, Reagan, that is, would he walk away with it?
Would he walk away with the
nomination?
As one of the pieces I quote is by a couple of conservatives who said if Reagan were alive today, he'd be, I can't remember the number, 103 years old. I mean, in other words, I don't think we can historically sort of drop somebody in a completely new circumstance. I think, you know, if you look at Reagan's record whole and look at what conservatives now say, they would be very critical of him. There were conservatives at the time, actually, who thought Reagan was a sellout, but they were a minority. I think that group of conservatives has grown, you know, that point of view in the party. So I suspect he would run into some resistance now. But the truth is you can't take a figure out of one period and drop him or her into another mm-hmm. and really, you can't honestly answer a question like that.
Let's go
it's
to
a good question, but I think
answer.
It's an unanswerable
right.
good question.
Oh, EJ. Nancy in Waterford, hi.
Hi. I was just thinking of the difficulty of dealing with conservatives now. I'm thinking of after the Powell memo and the takeover of the courts and redistricting of votes and Roger Ailes' big idea of the Fox News Network, which was his idea with Nixon being Republican news. And what we're dealing with is people with so much misinformation, you can't really discuss anything reasonably. And now that they have the gerrymandering and restricting voting so much that they have nothing to offer, so the only way they have, and they're in control in so many places, they are restricting people's votes, and it's just a takeover of control. They're not really concerned with Republicans, are not really concerned with governing and coming up with any answers to anything. It's just a matter of retaining their power.
EJ.
Well, first of all, I thank you for raising the Powell memo, which is I write about it in the book, and for those folks out there who aren't familiar with it, Lewis Powell, then a Virginia lawyer, later appointed to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon, wrote a memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that, as I write in the book, became a manifesto for a new business activism. Powell wrote, and I'm quoting, "The American economic system is under attack. The overriding first need is for businessmen to recognize that the ultimate issue may be survival of what we call the free enterprise system." And a lot of what happened, this is in the early 70s, and the Republicans and conservatives really took this to heart, and business began financing all sorts of academic institutions and pushing their ideas on college campuses around the country. You know, Powell's great enemy was Ralph Nader in this memo. And that led to an enormous amount of organizational creativity on the right. And as the caller said, you also had the attack on the so-called liberal media in that period. And again, conservatives responded by creating institutions. First, they created talk radio and Russia. They created their strong voice on talk radio after the Fairness Doctrine was repealed, and Rush Limbaugh spawned imitators all across the country. And I tell the story in the book. One of my favorite things about Roger Ailes and Fox News is he originally tried to turn Rush Limbaugh into a TV show. And if you look at Rush, he's not a natural TV figure. I say that with a certain sympathy. I could afford to lose some weight myself.
Oh, I don't think so. I see you on TV.
But, you know, but Ailes, rather than give up on his idea, just went bigger, and he created a whole network in 1996, which became number one, the number one cable network in the early 2000s in the Bush presidency. I think what you do have is a kind of a closed world. David Frum, the conservative, calls it the conservative entertainment complex. And I think one of the effects of this media world is that they have assumed power that used to be held by party leaders. And they can really kind of rule in and out of orthodoxy certain ideas. And one of my colleagues once said that if you're looking to interview conservative congresspeople and you need to catch them quick, you just stand outside Fox News in Washington, D.C., and all of them will come streaming by you. So, yes, there has been, I think, both the big money Frum calls talks about the radical rich, plus the rise of Fox and other conservative media, have had a real impact on this debate. I have some polling numbers, in fact, in the book about, you know, the difference in views among Republicans who listen to Fox and those who don't.
E.J. Dionne is our guest. We have time for a few more phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. His book is Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. Our number is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. E.J. Dionne is our guest. Before we go back to phone calls, just quickly, do you see at any time in the future, or will it take a loss, consistent loss of the presidential election, for the conservatives to move in a more moderate direction, E.J.?
I think that especially if the Republicans nominate somebody very much of the right, Cruz would be an obvious person for that. So conservatives in the party can say, we got our shot. And if that person loses the election, I think there will be a sort of taking of account inside the Republican Party, and that some people who've been more timid than I think they should be, given their views, because they are worried about losing primaries, will lose some of their timidity and just say, it cannot go on like this.
Mm-hmm.
Democrats took kind of stock after three defeats in the 80s. The British Conservative Party moved in a modernizing, moderate direction after Tony Blair beat them three times, and David Cameron, I'm personally to David Cameron's left, but this is a much more moderate brand of conservatism. I think that is what it will take. But there are a lot of structural forces making that very difficult, and in particular, as I said early on, the kinds of people who the Republican Party in its primary electorate is far more conservative than it was 20 years ago, so that you have this, you know, some establishment figures looking around for votes in primaries, a lot of the votes that might have been there 20 years ago are gone. So it's a structural problem. Last thing, it's an intellectual problem. I talk in the book about a group called the Reform Conservatives. I call them the Reformicons. They have made some efforts toward sort of trying to repair some of the problems on the right. But in my view, they have been not adventurous enough. And again, I think they would become somewhat more adventurous if the Republicans lost this election. Mm. If they win, then we're going to try this whole program of theirs. And I am of the view that it will not be popular with the country, because I just don't see how you cut back on government the way they talk about cutting back on government without turning off large parts of the country. And that's why government did not shrink under Ronald Reagan, and it didn't shrink under George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Brian in Milwaukee. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thank you. It seems that white working class people have become a large proportion of the Republican base of the electorate, but the leaders of the Republican Party have not really done anything to advance working class economic interests. And I'm wondering, Mr. Dionne, if he would agree with that, and if so, how he sees them reconciling that difference.
We have about a minute left.
Yeah, no, I said earlier on, I that is very much what I believe, and that's where partly I think Trump comes from. Whether he represents their interests or not, he's representing their anger at this very fact. There are some conservatives who are saying it's time for us to answer these grievances in a concrete economic way. The problem is, if you look at the donor class of the Republican Party, its policies are very much not in that direction. They want more tax cuts for the best off people. They tend to be against regulation. Republicans have to square this circle, because I don't think they'll be getting these white working class votes forever. But the Democrats also have to come up with an answer that these voters can believe in.
Mm. E.J., thank you ever so much. I'm so glad you have a national stage. You're always worth listening to.
That's very kind of you. It's always fun to do your show. So thank you so very much for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure, E.J. E.J. Dionne, our guest this hour, his book, again, is titled Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. E.J. is a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, professor at Georgetown University. He's the author of a number of books. books. We've interviewed him on several of them, including Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent, Why Americans Hate Politics, and a number of others. He's a regular commentator, as you know, on Fridays here on National Public Radio with David Brooks, and he's also frequently on MSNBC, and he will be, if he can get out of Washington, D.C., which he ought to be able to by next week. He will be in Iowa for the caucuses. Our next All Things Political is Monday of next week, and then it's a week until the caucuses. How about that? Julian Zelizer will be joining us. Julian is a professor of political science and history at Princeton University, and will have a lot to say about this year's campaign. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the show and for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee.